Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast to enjoy capercaillies in brandy sauce with a stuffing of black pudding made with live pig bloods, herbs, pepper, and of course, padding. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
I'm Todd.
And Patrick Troughton's back. It's the two Doctors. This story came about because of how thrilled John Nathan Turner was watching Patrick Troughton, Fraser Hines and Wendy Padbury in The Five Doctors, and sort of said to them on the spot while they were recording, hey, we're planning this three-part, well, equivalent of a six-part story in America next year. Would you like to come in on it? And Patrick and Fraser said, yeah, please. I think Wendy was pregnant with Charlie, which is part of the reason she's not back, her daughter Charlie.
Right.
Needless to say, this story is not set in America for a variety of reasons we'll go into a bit later. But it's this strange equivalent of a six-parter. John Nathan Turner hated six-parters. This is the only six-part equivalent story we get in his run. And he had Eric Saywood phone Robert Holmes, recently writer of The Caves of Androzani, and said, okay, we want you to write a big story. And Robert Holmes said, okay. And Eric Saywood said, it's set in America, it's got Patrick Troughton, Fraser Hines, and Sontarans, and the new Doctor, and Perry, and Robert Holmes just went, oh, God.
He always reacted really badly to being given a big kitchen sink script.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
the last
yeah.
time, I guess, was Power of Kroll, where he was told to include the biggest monster ever and really, really got annoyed and kind of left immediately afterwards. But I think that Robert Holmes is obviously one of the great writers that the series ever had. And I think it was kind of a strange decision of JNT to kind of veto older writers. And so it was a coup to get him back for Caves of Androzani. And I actually think that this is a reasonably good Bob Holmes script. And it has some clever things in it, which I don't know go sort of generally recognized. And I think it's a good fit for this season in that this season is all about kind of black comedies and they don't always come off. I've said that before, but Holmes is skilled. His instinct is to kind of go nasty, but he does it well. And there are scenes here that are genuinely funny.
Yeah, I agree. What do you think, Todd?
I love this. It's epic.
Hooray.
You know, it's the first six-episode story since Armageddon Factor.
Yeah, it's the longest story between sort of Armageddon Factor and Utopia Sound of Drums, Last of the Time Lords. And I don't even think that's one story, really.
No.
So it is properly epic. And I think, you know, like I think Holmes manages to get enough to happen in this to kind of justify three 45-minute episodes. I think there is some padding and there are some longers and stuff in it, but I think it generally works.
Patrick Troughton, or the Second Doctor, and Jamie turn up, and he's on a mission from the Time Lords.
Yeah.
Bit of a continuity problem. Now, I'm not sure what that's about, whether or not Holmes just misremembers, you know, the history of the Doctor around then. He just knows the Doctor was exiled to Earth. I don't know why Eric Saywood may not pick up on it. Or Ian Levine, the so-called continuity fan expert, to say, well, look, the Doctor's on a run from his own people, he's not going to reveal this information, you know?
Yeah. I think there's a problem with regarding Doctor Who as a consistent series of stories that chronicle the adventures of a particular individual. And so what's really happening here is that we get guest stars from the 60s. And now that the show is about a Time Lord from the planet Gallifrey in the constellation of Cerberus, who occasionally does go on missions to the Time Lords, that's just how we conceive of the Doctor, even though none of that stuff had actually happened. And I kind of find it off-putting to see Patrick Troughton's Doctor referred to as a Time Lord even, and to have him talk about Gallifrey. And I hate the conception that Gallifrey is a political force and there's the third zone governments and all of that just seems sort of, you know, tiresome and sort of Star Trek-y, you know, as if we're in a consistent universe rather than just a sort of series of stories. I dislike that a lot. And just the thought that the Doctor, like our Doctor, Patrick Troughton would go on a mission for the Time Lord seems so wrong. You know, none of those things ever got mentioned during his, you know, maybe the last two episodes of his time as the Doctor. Those things come up.
Yeah, I gather Robert Holmes has sort of, when he was still alive, he didn't live much longer after this, about 2 years, but someone raised it to him at a convention and he kind of put forward two different ideas at two different times. And one of the ideas he put forward was just saying, oh, you know, I realized after I wrote it and after we shot it that it was actually John who went on missions, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I just got confused because I hadn't been involved with the show for that long when John got involved. So I thought it was just always the case. The other thing he's actually put forward is what is now known as the Season 6B theory, which we've discussed before. But dear listeners, for those of you who are not aware, the Season 6B theory is that at the end of the War Games, the Celestial Intervention Agency, who were mentioned in The Deadly Assassin as having intervened in the Doctor's trial, pretty much rescue the Doctor and send him on clandestine missions. And this is not even the origin of it. There was a series of comics published between the War Games and Spearhead from Space where the Doctor is an agent for the Time Lords, exiled to Earth, but still in the form of Patrick Troughton, and is then lured into the TARDIS by a bunch of Time Lord-controlled scarecrows and forced to regenerate and land in a field with the final panel, a reproduction of the first shot that John Pertwee appears in falling out of the TARDIS. So we may never know what was actually going through John Nathan Turner's head. Ian Levine has, I believe, said that he did raise it with the production team, and because the pre-production of this story had been so troubled, they just kind of said, look, it's too late to do anything about it now. As I mentioned earlier, this story was meant to be set in New Orleans.
Mm.
J&T had gone on holiday there in 1980 and thought that the French Quarter, with its vibrancy, would make a fantastic location. He tried to secure extra funding from BBC Enterprises, kind of saying, Doctor Who's propping up BBC overseas sales. Can we see some more of that money, please? That didn't happen. So he made a deal with a production company called Lionheart, hired an American writer who wrote a treatment called Way Down Yonder. Didn't involve Androgums, did involve Sontarans, and was set in New Orleans. And one of the big payoffs it would have of the season was after three stories of the Doctor constantly berating Perry for her poor English, the Doctor would have no idea what anyone was saying in America, in New Orleans, and it would be up to Perry to sort of liaise and translate. The co-funding deal fell through.
Right.
And that was after Bob Holmes had written a New Orleans-based story, and he's like, French Quarter, New Orleans, food, I'll create these gastronomic aliens, an anagram of gourmand, the Androgums. And then when it switched to Spain, as he said, I didn't have time to come up with anything else, so they just stayed.
Well, you know, continuity is something that I always like to try and get out of. That 6B theory, I'm just going to go, I roll my eyes, listeners, I roll my eyes. I don't know, maybe the Doctor met the precursor of the CIA and they said, you have to go on this mission. So he mentions that to Jamie and all that's happening. And then just by pure luck, the sixth Doctor or the current Doctor, they meet. And as you know, when a previous incarnation meets the current incarnation, when they go back into their timeline, the web of time, works to erase that from their history. So all of that just, he forgets about it, Jamie forgets about it. And, you know, part of the CIA deal is not telling the Time Lords that he's out there and they've found him.
You know, there is actually a line of dialogue where Holmes tries to deal with the fact that Colin can't remember this story, which is that when Pat is strapped to a table and being operated on by Dastari, he's given a drug which he recognises and says has an effect on the memory. So I think that he was trying to deal with it. Look, I think the 6B theory just doesn't work. They've just dropped Victoria off to study graphology. You know, Jamie remembers the Doctor. Jamie knows what Time Lords are. It's just a mistake, you know. I think it is a shame because unlike the three Doctors and the five Doctors, I think we get Pat's best performance as the Doctor since he left the show. He's so much more like the actual Doctor than he is. He's kind of like an elder statesman when he comes back in the three Doctors, and he doesn't do that sort of panicky panting Pat, which I really, really love, which I think that Pete kind of references a little bit in his performance, and that's terrific. I think he's really funny. He's sort of mercurial. He's, you know, he's the old Pat rather than I'm here doing a guest star turn for this very special anniversary occasion. So I think that's really good. I think he's having terrific fun as Andragum Pat as well. I think he's really, really enjoying himself.
That is a whole weird sequence, especially when Shockeye, played wonderfully by John Stratton, wakes up and gets to do that whole wonderful speech about how he's been betrayed and, you know, for the first time shows what we would consider real sort of human emotion and vulnerability. You know, he cannot believe that Chassini has done this to him. But then 2 hours later when they come back from their meal, all is forgiven. He's not even thinking about it.
Yeah, no, he's distracted really by food.
namely on Sontaran's leg, but we'll come back to that.
I think Shockeye is extremely good in this, and I think that the Andragums are a really amazing monster. And people criticize this story because of Peter Moffat's direction, and I don't think Peter Moffat's direction is particularly good. But the big critique is that when the Sontarans first appear, they aren't given a sort of close-up or anything like that. There's really no sort of fanfare about it. And I think that that's because this isn't a story where the Sontarans are monsters. Stike and Vala are just characters. Holmes is not interested really in monsters. And the Andragums are, I think, a critique of the idea of monsters. And this is a point that Sandifer has made as well. But I think it's really clear that what he's created is a monster that looks essentially like human. I mean... Shockeye is like a sort of camp, you know, dissolute old queen, you know, who's dressed for a pantomime and just looks like a kind of old guy with sort of giant eyebrows. But whenever any of the characters describe the Andragums, they're like super strong and powerful. You know, Shockeye can drink 6 bottles of wine and eat an entire suckling pig and half a family paella at lunch with no ill effects. You know, he's superhuman and terrifying. So he's described as a monster, but he just looks like a person. And so everyone who talks about Andragums all throughout this story just seems like a horrific racist, you know, because they're essentially just people. And even to the point where Colin, you know, ends up gassing Shockeye with Oscar's cyanide. Mm. And that seems terrible because it's just Colin killing a person, but the person is spoken of as being a monster all the way through. And it kind of serves as a critique of the idea of monsters, that monsters are a kind of basically xenophobic or racist idea, that that the Andragums are evil because they're Andragums and you can't genetically engineer them. Pat compares Chassini to a monkey in like a really horrifically racist line. And so I think that's intentional. I don't think that the material is getting away from Holmes here. I think he's setting out to deliberately critique the idea of monsters in Doctor Who.
There seems to be a scene in every story of this season where the Doctor gets to be violent, and that's become a focal point of what people talk about. I have no problem with the gassing scene because we have seen that Shockeye does not have what we would consider a sense of reason. So the Doctor saying, hold on, can't we discuss this? Well, the Doctor has just had to rescue both Perry and Jamie from being literally butchered by this man. Mm. And the Doctor has a massive gash in his leg and is bleeding profusely from that, enough to leave a blood trail. So the Doctor's just in the situation of, I've got no choice here. And the thing is, it's very different to the situation of the Doctor going and pointing a gun in Davros's face, as I know you objected to last year, Nathan, because it's the Doctor being pursued rather than the Doctor doing the pursuing. Even the just desserts line, I don't see that as a gloating line. That is an expression of relief, like this situation is over. He doesn't really take any pleasure in the killing. Like when he comes back, he sort of just obliquely refers to what he's done, just like Shockeye's been mothballed and let's move on and let's not discuss it.
I actually object more strongly to other things this season, like the Doctor gunning the cyber controller in the face and the Doctor shooting Daleks with a big gun in Revelation, I don't like very much. But I'm not that worried about this, partly because it's sold by the kind of desperation that the Doctor's in and the chase and all of that sort of thing, and partly because I think it intends to be problematic. It is the Doctor gassing a guy in the face, but the guy's a monster, and the Doctor kills monsters, you know. So I don't think that that's bad at all. And in fact, that chase is wonderfully well directed.
Yeah.
I'm laughing my head off because I came in here thinking that I would have to have a battle on my hands to justify that sequence with Nathan. That's been in my head all week.
Yeah.
So I've been very silent listening to you both. And I agree. And that chase is brilliant. And I think Peter Moffat's direction on location, I really love it.
Yeah. I think he does one or two good shots in the studio as well. I don't think it's that interesting, but there are one or two shots which I think are good. The direction's a bit flat and a bit unremarkable, but it's not terrible. And certainly, you know, the big complaint about the reveal of the Sontarans I don't think is a problem at all. Music helps too, the chase. The music in the chase is wonderful.
I can't do the music, whatever it is.
Yeah, with the guitar.
Great. That's fantastic. And I also love the Sontaran, like the battle, you know,
yeah,
music.
The Sontaran music is great.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Something I love about the Sontaran reveal is actually the reveal in dialogue when their ships are coming towards it and the computer tells the fabulous Jacqueline Pierce Sontaran battle cruisers approaching. I think that's a great touch because fans who've been watching since 1978 or had the Doctor Who Monster book will go, oh my God, the Sontarans are back. And people who don't know the Sontarans will just go, what was that word? What does that mean? And it creates intrigue. I actually have a note here, which is, I think this is the worst Colin Baker story.
I think it might be the best.
But I think part of the reason for that is when they lose the American location and they have to lose all the wordplay that was going to be in there, because instead of having our core cast of characters who speak British English and another core cast of characters who speak American English, we have our core cast of characters who speak English, and then if we have a core cast of Spanish characters, they have to speak Spanish or they have to speak English as well, like Anita. So you lose that language play. And I just feel there are long bits where not a lot happens. And I kind of feel that maybe they should have looked at the script and gone, I know we wanted to make this a six. Let's look at what we can do with this other episode somewhere in the season and make it a two-parter.
Certainly the stuff in the ducting at the end of episode one and the beginning of episode two is a bit boring.
In the six-part version,
yeah.
Right, so we've got episode one.
Oh, yes.
with Pat getting there, the Doctor's off fishing. Don't do that, you'll frighten the fish is one of my all-time favourite lines ever. Like, I just burst out laughing every time. Like, I've been fishing and I've been bored and throwing things going, when are we going to catch some fish? So I can understand Paul Perry's predicament.
And it's the Doctor being incompetent in a rather sweet way as well. So he catches, and we've got the most valuable fish in the universe this time. It's a Holmes script. And Gumblejack is such a Bob Holmes word.
It is, isn't it? Mm. But then, of course, at the end of that episode one of the six-part version, of course, Perry and the Doctor have arrived on the station and they're assessing the situation, and we've got that wonderful cliffhanger. You know, the Doctor says it threatened no one, and then the computer says it threatened the Time Lords. Cue Sting, which I just think it's a fantastic. But then we've got 25 minutes, another 20 minutes of this second half of this 45 minute episode, where basically it's the Doctor and Perry bitching at each other through the ducting and all around the station. And I think it's, in terms of the season and in terms of this story, I think it's the 25 minutes that I like the least.
Yeah.
The moment that they meet Jamie, again, having that third person in with them just improves everything, you know?
Yeah,
and then there's that wonderful scene where the Doctor actually, you know, finds the fake deaths of Perry and that he's really concerned and everything. That's at the beginning of the next episode, I think. And everything just picks up from there. But all that ducting stuff, you know? And then Jamie attacking Perry, like,
Yeah, I don't know why he becomes a strange monster from the trauma of seeing the Doctor killed or whatever.
Mm. Something I found watching that first episode, and it was when I was watching that scene with the Doctor and Perry in Dastari's office. And on the commentary, you have Colin, Nicola, Peter Moffat, Fraser, and Jackie Pierce, sort of, and they slightly vary. But that's a 7-minute scene. And Colin and Nicola are praising Peter Moffat. And, you know, nobody was doing that on television anymore. Yeah, because you get bored. But what I was thinking when I was watching that was, imagine if the story started with the Doctor and Perry fishing.
Yeah.
Then you go into the TARDIS, the Doctor collapses, and you flash back to Pat, and you tell the two stories on the station simultaneously with each other. So when the Doctor and Perry are in Dastari's office, you then cut back to Patrick and Jamie in Dastari's office having a go at him. When the Doctor and Perry are going through the ducts, you then have Jamie seeing the Doctor. Because the problem with Colin's Doctor and Perry exploring the station is that the plot is now happening with Patrick elsewhere, and we have to delay them getting to that plot in order for Patrick's plot to sort of move on a bit. I really like the Doctor and Perry relationship in this story, and when they're going through the ducting, I think the bitching is actually at the perfect level. For instance, the Doctor's being pompous, but he's not being nasty,
yeah.
And Perry's being fed up, but she's not traumatized, you know what I mean? There's that bit where Perry has something really important to say, like, I think there's a creature following us, and the Doctor tells her off for interrupting him, and she should feel privileged. I can't tell you how privileged I feel. She's great. There's that whole bit with hold your arms up and slide down. What if I get stuck? Well, I shouldn't advise that. I'll be right behind you. Colin in this is amazing. He's got these wonderful speeches. He's got that speech about death and decay, which is horrifying, but it's so well delivered. He's got that speech about the possible death of the universe, and he brings it all down to there'll be no more butterflies.
No more gumblejacks.
No more gumblejacks.
That is the worst kind of word peril, though, isn't it? And we throw it away quite quickly.
Yeah,
for a little
true.
While, we think the universe is going to be destroyed, but we're just told that in a speech by Colin, and then it goes away.
See, this is why having a non-linear story would work, because if we didn't know whether Patrick was still alive at that point or not, it would actually raise the peril.
We don't actually know that. Have we seen Pat being carried by the Sontarans in episode one? Have
yeah,
we
that
seen
happens
that by
in
that
the back
point?
Half of episode one.
Okay. Because it's a long time that we don't see him, isn't it? It's strangely paced, and it does suffer from that 45-minute thing. It's 10 minutes before Colin and Nicola are even in it. That's okay, because the stuff with the Doctor and Jamie is kind of
exactly.
fun.
Exactly. You know, the Doctor has arrived in the story.
a Doctor has. But Colin doesn't get to be in the story until well into episode two. And so that is a bit of a problem.
I love your idea of running all that parallel, Brendan. I think one of the listeners out there needs to do a re-edit and post it up to YouTube, because that would be very, very interesting. Obviously, in this first episode, we're introduced to other characters.
Do you know, I'd forgotten that Jacqueline Pierce was in this.
But it's not Servalan. It's pitched so perfectly between being just too camp and just the right sort of, you know, villainous sort of thing. I don't know. It's just something that's delicious. I think everybody in this story pitches their performance very similarly, like within a range that works. And I think we've seen in other stories this season, certainly one coming up, where you suddenly got a huge range so you can see who's over the top and who's really crap. Yeah. Whereas in this, I think everybody is universally very good. Dastari, I think, is one of the performances of the year.
Yeah.
He was in The Gunfighters, wasn't he?
Yes.
And he just manages to have that warmth, and you can see the whole character journey, and it just holds everything together. It's so believable.
He's Morix in episode one of The Leisure Hive as well.
Oh, the original.
Yeah,
Who I really liked too, is the original.
He's got a great thing in episode three where he gradually becomes more and more sort of disgusted and disappointed with Chassini, which I think he sells quite well.
And I think also disappointed in himself, because Chassini is his achievement. She is a possession to him. Then he's got this realization that actually she's got her own personality and her own thoughts, which kind of intrigues him. And then I think it's when she orders the conversion of the Doctor into an Andragum.
Yeah.
Which...
Oh, she kills people as well, I think.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, she kills people on the base. But that's part, you know, he's part of the plan.
Yeah.
In that. But when she breaks free and she starts doing her own thing, and then when she starts to regress, Jackie Pierce in that scene where she just lays down on the ground and rubs blood in her face.
Mm.
You know, for years, we as genre fans, of course, Todd, you referred to Serverland, Jacqueline Pierce's famous role for 4 years in Blake 7. That's how we know Jacqueline Pierce. She is utterly sophisticated and utterly ruthless. To see her playing a character here who is also sophisticated and also ruthless, but then regresses into savagery, and she sells it completely. You know, there are actors who, they've got their niche, and they play their niche, and they're very good at it. And Jacqueline Pierce, for the first two episodes of the story, you'd say, okay, it's this niche where she's the strangely sexy and alluring, intelligent villainess. But then you get that scene, and you're just like, wow, you know, she can play what we would see as savage character as well. Peter Moffat may not be a great visual director, but reflecting on his stories, he gets good performances out of people. So maybe he's one of these people you would call an actor's director, you know.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question? When you watched this, Brendan, did you know Jacqueline as Serverland? Because as a kid, I hadn't really watched Blake 7. Like, I might have seen an episode and thought, what is this? I'm never going to watch it. This is sub-Doctor Who. Like, I was very anti-anything but Doctor Who. So I didn't really recognise her from that, and I just loved Chassini, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that was my journey.
I don't think I did know her because I vividly remember – I remember knowing what Blake 7 was, probably from the Doctor Who special effects book by Matt Irvine. But I distinctly remember when I was about 12 watching Blake 7 for what I believe is the first time. And it was the edited movie compilation of the first three episodes. So, yeah, I remember being terrified by the sequence where Nova gets killed in Spacefall, you know, with the perforated walls.
And the BBC foam machine.
Yeah, but, you know, when you're 12.
Yeah. But you didn't really know her as Serverland.
No,
Serverland.
Absolutely not.
I mean, it's the dialogue in this story. I mean, it's Holmes, right?
Yeah.
And she get, you know, I'm going back to episode one of the three-parter. She gets that moment, what does it say? That noble history lies behind us, but ahead lies a vision. And somebody somewhere has done an edit of that shot going straight into the Blake 7 end credits. It's hilarious. It's just wonderful. But there's other things like, you know, Shockeye will talk about Tellurians. You know?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Which was Holmes's word for Earth people in Carnival of Monsters.
Yeah. And it's little things like that that I just love.
I love Shockeye catching the rat and biting into it and saying, smoke dried, it might just be tolerable.
In fact, that scene is incredibly funny, and people say, oh, you know, it's terribly tonally inappropriate, and it is kind of tonally inappropriate, and in the context of the season, maybe it's a bit too much, but gee, it's funny. Like, he twists its neck and takes a bite out of it, and then there's like a rat with a big cartoon bite taken out of the side of it that he's waving around. The other thing, which is really horrible, is the way that he's clearly eaten the Doña Rana.
That is so fantastic. Like, oh, I detect great age. And then she hobbles in. What does she say? Something about your English? No, cat or whatever. Well,
that's the other thing too. So it's Dastari, who's from the third zone and this sort of stupid space station. There's some Sontarans and some Andragums. Walk into a bar. And the Doña Rana hears them speak. I think it's Shockeye says, it cannot see. And she goes, you are English? So clearly in the Doctor Who universe, everyone speaks English except for non-English speaking people on Earth. But again, and it has that hilarious thing where she goes away from an altar, like she's been praying, and you get that line of dialogue from Shockeye where he says, I'm not interested in the beliefs of primitives, only in what they taste like.
And then a few scenes later, when Chassini's talking about the knowledge she's gained from the Doña Arada, Shockeye says something like, oh, can we find another one? There was not much meat on the bone.
It's fantastic. I'm laughing my head off now. I just have this black sense of humor, and it just tickles my fancy.
But the great thing is, too, where I said that the Andragums are coded as monsters and that's what's so weird about them is that he's also really, really human. I mean, there is this implication that human beings are monsters. And, you know, this season has a lot of cannibalism in it, which is not anything we've had to say about Doctor Who before. But, you know, as human beings, we're basically sort of chewing our way through entire ecosystems and seeing millions and millions of animals every year killed in order to feed us. And you know, that's not that different from Shockeye. The implication is that Shockeye is going to eat a lot of people. Remember, this planet is grossly overpopulated. Mm. And he says that, and he says that by the time he leaves the planet, that may no longer be a problem.
and of course, when he's tenderizing Jamie, he's saying that the writhing and the screaming, oh no, that's just a reflex action. These animals don't feel pain the way you or I do.
Yeah, yeah. All of those justifications that we make for our treatment of animals. And like, I'm not a vegetarian. I'm not going to be a vegetarian anytime soon. But the moral argument for vegetarianism is pretty strong, and it's not hard to imagine that if we all survive the climate change crisis, which seems increasingly unlikely, our descendants will look back on us and think, what on earth were we doing eating all of these animals? It is a real kind of moral blind spot that we have. And Holmes satirizes it, I think, in a sensible way. They're like us, only worse.
Because Holmes, of course, was vegetarian himself. Nicola Bryant is vegetarian, and it was actually Nicola Bryant who walked up to him with the script and said, are you a vegetarian? And,
right.
And he said, yeah. And she said, I thought so. She was kind of like one of the few people who got that aspect of the script, that it was an indictment on our practices. And it's why the last line of the story is, from now on, it's a healthy vegetarian diet for both of us. As the discontinuity guide points out, having the two doctors as a message for vegetarianism is like having a Peter Greenaway film try to criticize pornography.
Yeah.
Or Sam Peckinpah criticizing a slasher film. Speaking of slasher films, of course, we've had a slasher film influence earlier this year with Vengeance on Varos, which was not only a sort of reaction to the growing horror film market, but a satire of it. A lot of people have compared, especially the location scenes, especially the chase scenes involving Shockeye, so when he's chasing down Perry, when he's chasing down the Doctor, to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which was made about 10 years before this, but was still a horror icon, and especially with the resurgence in slasher films towards the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, and right through till now. Friday the 13th was still going. Nightmare on Elm Street, I think, premiered 1984. So it's Doctor Who doing what other shows do, as Richard would always point out. And that, I think, is part of the reason I don't have a big problem with the violence in this story. You know, I've said I consider this the worst Colin Baker story. It's still very watchable. It's just the long pauses sometimes between anything happening. But thankfully, those long pauses are filled with excellent performances. So when I say it's the worst Colin Baker story, I don't think it's bad. I just think a 70-minute edit would be lovely.
There's two cliffhangers that I want to talk about. The end of the 45-minute part two, where Perry is being pursued by Shockeye.
Which is, I think it's more evidence that he's the monster. He gets the big final cliffhanger.
Yeah. Hear my pretty one. And the music and her running away, fantastic. But in the six-part story, in the middle of that episode, of course, we get, I think, one of the best cliffhangers of all time, where I think the Doctor or someone says, like, where is this hacienda? And Anita goes, it is this way. They walk off. I just laugh my head off. I think it's a fantastic little...
And the very next scene is the second Doctor freaking out because he thinks Jamie's dead. It's like, well, that's a better cliffhanger, even though we know Jamie's alive. At least it shows some distress. Yeah. But yeah, the hacienda is this way.
I love Anita and Oscar.
That actor is 27 years old, I think.
At that time.
Yeah. I don't think he's with us any longer, but I think he's really good. I think he's really funny, and he helps to reinforce that theme of human beings being evil, because when we first see him, he's gassing moths.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's telling that cyanide is used to kill Shockeye later, but he's using poison to kill animals for his pleasure. And Anita critiques that a little bit. But he's that kind of typical Holmesian, you know, huge performance. And we've got two of them here. We've got Shockeye as well. In fact, we get Shockeye and Pat as a fantastic Holmesian double act.
Yeah.
I think Oscar's really funny and sort of terribly sweet. And one of the criticisms that gets leveled against this story is the way that he's killed in episode three. And, you know, he doesn't need to be killed. The Spanish truck driver who gets killed doesn't need to be killed either.
Yeah.
But Shockeye is a monster. And in order to make him not just be a comedy panto character. He does need to kill people. And I think, you know, the scene where Oscar is killed is funny and kind of touching. You know, he's sort of pompous, he's ludicrous. Belief that he could ever do a definitive Hamlet is like terribly sweet.
And a very cruel reference to Matthew Waterhouse, if I may say.
But the doctor gets to do a little bit of good acting there, and Perry reacts to it. It works really well. And he's safe. You know, those comedy characters, those Christopher Benjamin-style characters in a Bob Holmes story don't get killed. And so it is Holmes being cynical and it is Holmes being nasty, but I think it's intentional, and I don't think it fails. I think that scene works.
I think so too.
And it's got to be upsetting. You know, killing Andragoff, who cares? But killing Oscar Botcherby, you know, we care about that. That's what drama's supposed to do.
Look, I am going to dissent on a point. I think the death of Oscar is one of the biggest tone-deaf moments of this entire era.
Right.
Simply because it's a massive missed opportunity. His character has been painted and built up as this camp, hammy ex-actor who's done something in his old theatre group and is in self-imposed exile.
Yeah.
Like Anita says, maybe the consulate will forgive you or you on a forthcoming tour. So we don't know what he's done or to whom he's done it. Is this around the time Richard Marston was having to fend Gary Downey off with a script to Time Flight? I wonder if that's a reference. But every time I watch that scene as a kid, I expect at the end when Anita's sobbing into his shirt for her to get up, slap him and say, "You're still breathing!" and walk off. You know, it feels to me like that is him doing his hammy death scene because he thinks he's going to die, but then actually he'll be okay.
But, I mean, I think that would work. Holmes is... Well, we've said this before. Holmes is really cynical and he needs reining in. And Terence Dix was able to rein him in during the Pertwee era. And his scripts, I think, for Pertwee are the best scripts of that era. I think Eric Saward is disinclined probably even to edit him very much because Eric Saward has the good taste to realise that he's an extremely good Doctor Who writer. But he does tend towards the cynical, and there is a feeling to Botcherby's death, which is, I'm going to get the Doctor Who fans here, you know, because Botcherby is a comedy character who should be safe. He's going to shock us. And he actually writes the novelization for this. Do you remember this, Todd? It's the 100th Target novelization. It's the only one he writes. It's specially released. I listened to it reasonably recently because Colin actually reads it.
Oh, wow.
And he does a great job. You know, he's got a terrific voice. He does a terrific Sixth Doctor impression. It's really something. And there is an extremely revoltingly nasty scene where Shockeye imagines in detail what it would be like for Perry to be cooked in an oven. And it's really, really revolting. And so Holmes is always tending in that direction, and he probably does need to be reined in. He's not being reined in here. And the next script that he does for the program, because a lot of history's happened between now and then, he's super careful and actually ends up writing something completely anodyne and fairly uninteresting. Here, when he's kind of given his head, yeah, you know, maybe he goes too far, but it's Bob Holmes going too far, and that's so much better than, you know, Glenn McCoy going too far.
You see, on the one hand, I kind of object because the only other function that Anita and Oscar have in the plot is showing them where the hacienda is. And it's not like they're that far away from it anyway. So, you know, they probably would have found it themselves without them. So it becomes the only function of them in the plot is cannon fodder.
Right.
But on the other hand, if this is a satire of slasher films, Anita's the final girl.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, except for Nightmare on Elm Street 2, there's always a young girl left alive at the end. The other thing I love about their characters, and because I've watched this recently, one of Rod's Christmas presents was also The Complete Enterprise on Blu-ray, so we've been watching season one of that, and there's a subplot in season one of a young female crew member developing a crush on Dr. Phlox. And as the actress says in an interview, she's like, oh, you know, yeah, I could have had a crush on the chief engineer who's a hunk, but Dr. Phlox, he's kind of like the comforting older man uncle kind of figure, and that's much more interesting to play. And it's like, you can see that Anita fancies Oscar a little bit for some reason, yeah. Like when they're out moth hunting and he doesn't notice because he's after his bots.
Yeah.
And there's something
and
very
probably
sweet.
Gay.
And probably gay. There's something very sweet about those two characters together and when she's bossing him around in the restaurant and whatnot.
But I like how she likes the sixth doctor and gives him kisses and poor Jamie's left, you know, waiting for his. I like yes. those little comedy moments.
Yeah,
I
think yeah. He does get a kiss from Perry, but he kind of he inflicts himself on her a bit.
Yes.
He's always played for comic purposes, really, apart from, you know, when he's discovered in his nest in episode two. He
gets with the a lot exposition of funny bits. Coma.
Yeah, yeah. An exposition coma. I'd forgotten about exposition
coma. Exposition coma.
So we have exposition coma. We have word peril. We have the most valuable fish in the universe.
The moment this moves from the space station onto location, around the hacienda, in the hacienda, all the runarounds down in Seville, I just love it. I just love all that location work, all the bits of dialogue, you know, double-crossed centaurans and oh, I'm just sitting here listening to you guys loving it. And as I said earlier in this podcast, I thought you weren't going to. And so I'm just so thrilled that that is the case.
I think that there's a bit of a problem with the location work in that I think it is a big shame that it's like 17 minutes into episode three before we get to Seville. We've been talking about it. The scenes in Seville look beautiful, like they look amazing, all of those scenes in alleyways and stuff. We've got everyone on location. I think it's bizarre that Stike and Val get to be on location and discussing things that they could equally have done in that sort of giant cellar, you know, studio, but instead they're outside the hacienda having a chat. I think that's terribly good. I love seeing Dastari walking through the streets of Seville and no one really kind of noticing. I think all of that's really great.
Friends of the podcast, Brian Lindsay and Simon Moore, have been there and they actually said Seville is even more beautiful. And the locations that they use are literally like little back alleys and things that don't really show off the city. Like, and we think that's beautiful. They said you should see the rest of it.
Yeah, they probably did that to avoid tourists obviously. And get clean shots.
I think it takes too long for the two doctors to meet. Like, you really are wanting them to get together. I would have liked to have seen them perhaps a bit like the three doctors where they meet earlier and then get separated and then come back together. I mean, it's not until part three of the 45-minute thing that we get, you know, that little scene where they sort of, they meet briefly and then you're just going, I want them to talk to each other, you know?
Yeah. They get snapped wrong. You know, they look at each other and go snap, which is actually quite a funny line, but they miss time it. You can see the actors watching each other to try and get the timing right, and they don't. But we don't go again because it's Peter Moffat.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. I don't blame them for that. I blame Peter Moffat for that.
I love the explosion of the Sontaran spaceship. It was twice the size that it needed it to be. If you watch the documentary on the actual DVD, they explain that they had to buy pyrotechnics in. They couldn't get it into the country, and then it was too big. The typical thing where it's like, oh yes, it's only going to be like yay big, and then it's suddenly three times the size, and people down the road thought there was some massive problem, you know?
Yeah. I think it's because, surprisingly enough, even then they didn't like explosives going on planes. But I gather it's also they had a certain budget for it based on what they would pay in England. But for some reason, explosives are much cheaper in Spain at the time with the exchange rate. So instead of going, okay, well, you know, we were going to buy X amount, we'll buy X amount. It's like, oh, we can buy 3X. Okay, let's do that.
What's the end of episode five in the six-part version? Is it the doctor putting his head in that fountain? Yeah.
So the doctor starts fantasizing about eating cats. and then he sort of douses his head in a fountain and says something about how it's only going to get worse, and that was our kind of cliffhanger. Mm. I think all of that stuff is fine. You know, it doesn't really go anywhere, but it puts an extra bit of pressure on the sixth doctor. You know, there's something about Colin's performance here in this story which I really like, and I really like him on location. And it turns out when he's not in a garish studio set trying to outshout the studio lighting, and when he's just on location in a normal place, he plays it down. And initially I had thought it was because it was really hot and he didn't have the energy to kind of do his normal kind of overacting. But he'll do it again in Revelation of the Daleks, where he gets an entire episode where he's only on location and it's really cold there, so it's not the temperature. I think it is something to do with just it's easier to act on location because you're in a real situation, and there's a temptation when you're in a kind of crummy light entertainment set to go big. And Colin is still recognisably the Sixth Doctor in those scenes, but there's just something underplayed about it. And I do wish he'd underplayed it more, because he is charming and he is funny. And even when he's being a little bit obnoxious, he's not unlikable. And yeah. I guess it goes back to my idea that making the Doctor unlikable was always a terrible idea, particularly when it's clear that JNT casts Colin because Colin is charming, you know, and witty, you know, and clever.
Do you think it also helps the fact that he's not wearing the coat on location?
I really like the waistcoat.
It's a good one.
Yeah. It's better than Pete's horrible woolly one on Lanzarote.
There's a big Finnish Doctor Who box set called The Sixth Doctor, The Last Adventure,
yeah.
which is a story arc of four stories at different points in the Sixth Doctor's life leading up to his regeneration. The one with India Fisher as Charlie Pollard, a fan did a fan cover of that, and because it's referred to, I believe, in the script, it's been a while since I listened to it, the Doctor actually loses his coat in it. In the cover, the artist has put him on in that waistcoat. And it's like, yeah, we need more of that as well. There exists a customized action figure of him in that waistcoat, a wonderful customizer called Selkie. It is such a nice costume touch. And yeah, wouldn't it have been great to actually just have a Doctor without a coat for a little while? You know, we've got another two stories this season. Let's just keep him in that.
Yeah.
And it would have been an in-universe explanation as to why we're getting rid of the coat.
In fact, it is kind of boring, isn't it, that all of JNT's Doctors until Sylvester McCoy all have knee-length coats, as if that's what the Doctor has to wear. He has to wear knee-length coats, but they're all sort of different colours, and that's how we tell the Doctors apart. And I think there are problems with Sylvester McCoy's costume, but I was so relieved to get rid of the knee-length coat. And here, I really think that Colin's costume works here. I love the tie that he's got jammed in his pocket that sort of trails around behind him when he's running. That looks really good.
There's some common criticisms of this story we haven't mentioned, so I thought I might mention some of them now. Nathan, you did touch upon briefly earlier the possibility of, you know, kind of racist to Andragums. And people often cite that bit at the beginning where the Second Doctor is saying, you know, I don't care about the pedigree of an Andragum, I'm a Time Lord. And people are like, oh no, the Second Doctor wouldn't do that. It's like, well, he would slam a lawyer's head into a desk.
He would gun ice warriors down with a big gun. I mean, that's part of the point. It's about monsters.
Yeah, he would certainly throw his weight about. Look, he does exactly the same thing in the War Games when he's pretending to be someone from the War Office. You know, I have no problem with that scene. And later on, the Sixth Doctor says, we've got no time to worry about dead Andragums, Perry. It's like, you might think, oh, that's cruel and that's harsh. It's like, what else is he going to do?
I think it's deliberate. I think it is deliberate that Holmes has created a race of monsters that just look like people and is now critiquing a problematic attitude towards monsters that the show's always had.
Yeah. Mm. And finally, the tall Sontarans that people criticise.
I think the Sontarans are pretty terrible. They look terrible. And I don't think they've got the mask right since the Sontaran experiment. Because it always seemed like Kevin Lindsay's head was kind of encased in a big fiberglass thing, which is because it was. Whereas here, when Chassini's throwing chronic acid on them, like Vaal kind of deflates because he's killed. Yeah. But Stike puts his hand on his head and inadvertently like squashes the mask. He presses too hard. And so I don't think the masks look very good. And they're tall, you know, we never go back to that. And I don't think that matters all that much. And they're funny and pompous and silly military characters of the kind that Holmes creates all the time.
I love Stike's scenes with the Second Doctor, like when he's saying, the loneliness of command, and the Doctor's like, why don't you retire? I may have made a miscalculation. He scratches his head. But the tall thing, way back when, in The Time Warrior, the Doctor does refer to them as being from a high-gravity planet, which is why they're so short. So if they're coming, if they know they're coming to a planet with lower gravity, they might breed a special taller Sontaran. I mean, why not? And also, this is the first time where we haven't just gone, oh, they've got a probic vent, let's stick something in it.
Yeah, it's because they're not the monsters here, they're just characters. And they're Sontarans.
Like, I like that.
Yeah, I do too. I think that's great.
When was the last time they were in the show, The Invasion of Time? Look at how great they were in that.
Yeah,
you know?
Terrible masks again.
Yeah, yeah, so at least here they've got character again because Storr didn't really have a character. You know, he just got to say Doctor.
Going back to a point you made, I love the interaction with both the Second Doctor and the Sixth Doctor. I think there's some really witty lines. I love the fact that the Sixth Doctor fools them into thinking that the module is working, you know.
Yeah.
And even as a kid, I was fooled by that. Like, I thought, okay, it's all primed and ready to go, but of course, yeah, it's not.
It's another thing of Holmes just helping himself to continuity. So the Time Lords have symbiotic nuclei in their heads that helps them operate the TARDIS, which is something that we will never refer to again and have never referred to before. But it is his usual habit. I mean, he invents Time Lords having two hearts. He invents the 12 regeneration limit. He invents the planet Gallifrey.
Yes.
So here he's inventing something else. This one doesn't take, but it is just another example of that.
Can I talk about the ratings?
Certainly. Yeah.
Episode 1 got 6.6 million viewers, which is down by 0.7 from the previous week, and it placed 92nd. Episode 2, 6 million viewers, which is the lowest rating of the season, and it came 90th. And it's after that episode that Michael Grade axed the show.
Yeah.
Episode 3, 6.9 million, 66th on the chart, 25 places higher.
So weird, isn't it? It's impossible to interpret.
It's all over the place because Time Lash actually gets higher ratings, but its placings are all over the place as well.
The big criticisms of Doctor Who that lead to the cancellation are happening as early as season 21, aren't they? Things like Warriors of the Deep, which I didn't like very much, but I didn't think was hugely terrible. But it does have some pretty bad production problems, like the Murker.
Yeah. But, you know, Grade's come in and, you know, he doesn't like the show. I mean, if you look at the ratings, if you purely at, you know, 8.9 million for the first episode, we're now down to 6 million with two doctors.
He's
looking for ammunition. Fans are already criticising it for violence, etc. And, you know, so he pulls the pin.
Yeah.
Even though it's 10 weeks away from next season and they've already lined up scripts and even location work for the first story.
And I believe even contracted Michael Goff.
Oh, really? Wow. Yeah. What can I say? That's where we're at. If the pin hadn't been pulled, would the ratings have continued to slide? Because actually from this point in, there's this gradual increase to the end of the season.
Right.
Yeah, because people realise, oh, my God, it's going, you know. One of the criticisms Michael Grade raised was shortly after becoming controller of BBC One, he just switched on the TV one night, didn't actually know what was on, and it was Doctor Who. You know, he's never gone into detail about what story it was, but he's like, Return of the Jedi has just come out and we're putting out this with cardboard sets and right angles everywhere and bright flood studio lighting. We can't afford to compete and that's why I cancelled it. That's what he says. There are more scurrilous rumours as to the reason.
I mean, I do think that there's a general tiredness due to the fact that John Nathan Turner's been on the show since
1977?
Or since Talons of Weng Chiang.
Dang. Yeah. 76.
And so he's been doing it for a really long time, like getting on for 10 years at this point. And he's not someone with much vision about how the show should work as television. And no one's really thinking about why we're still doing it. I think we've made this point
before. You've made the point before, yeah.
That we're doing it out of habit. And it really, really did need, by this point, a new
producer and script editor.
Yeah.
I mean, I know, possibly not on this podcast, I can't remember, but I know, speaking with you guys, that I have at times compared the Matt Smith era to the Colin Baker era, in that it seems to me at times you have a great actor in the role, but they're not being given great material. But I will say that one thing I could never accuse Stephen Moffat of is not having a clear vision of what he wants to do.
Oh, look, we're getting ahead of ourselves. But I don't think I would agree with that. I think you can see Moffat flailing and not sure of what to do.
But that's the thing. JNT never seems to have a creative vision. He leaves that up to the script editor, which with Christopher Hamilton Bidmead was absolutely fine. I'm currently reading Totally Tasteless, The Life of John Nathan Turner by Richard Marson. And there's a bit in that where Christopher Bidmead talks about why he left the show. And basically it was because, you know, he had this great vision. And he had plans for the show beyond his season that he did, but he viewed his role and sort of his role on paper was just to technically edit the scripts.
Yeah.
The Doctor Who script editor is never that. And he quite rightly said, look, I'm doing far more work than that. Can I have a rise? And the head of serials just said, look, it's the BBC. You know, you get paid for your bracket. And he kind of said, okay, look, that is perfectly fair, but I'm going to go. Eric Saywood, as I've said before, if he had only been script editor for 2 years, I think he would be remembered far more fondly than he is. And I'm not saying that's a universal thing. I know there are people who appreciate his work greatly, just as there are people who don't rate Stephen Moffat highly, and there are people who think he's the greatest producer the show ever had, and there's people in between. Eric Saywood's vision, like anyone's vision, is limited to a set amount of time. And I think with this season, we've kind of gone even further than the furthest we can go with it, and the show's starting to repeat itself. Unfortunately. And that's a big shame for Colin, because Colin is bringing something new, but he's bringing something new to stale material.
Yeah, I'm going to disagree with you about Saywood, but I'm going to save it for two episodes' time. I think Saywood's vision for the show is changing visibly during the Colin Baker era, and I think it's changing a bit for the better, but I do think all of the things, all of the horrible, horrible things I've been saying about him over the last few episodes are true. He wasn't experienced enough. He's not quite talented enough. He has some good instincts, like recognizing that Bob Holmes is a great Doctor Who scriptwriter, but he's a problem, and I'd like to blame him for everything that's going wrong in the whole world.
Moffat, Delta and the Bannerman.
Yeah, global warming.
Eric Roberts. Well, while we go off to whip up a batch of nut roast rolls, don't forget to come back to us next week as we explore that anagramical Doctor Who story, Shamelit. Until then, we'll be opening a poll with this episode. Now, quick update. We haven't forgotten. We've promised you a commentary on Enemy of the World. The reason we haven't recorded that yet is a couple of weeks ago, Richard actually had an injury which has left it difficult for him to attend recording. So we will be releasing that Patrick Troughton commentary at the end of this season. We will also be releasing shortly after that our John Pertwee commentary. So you know how it works by now. We've all nominated a story, and we would like you to go ahead and vote for those. So I have nominated Spearhead from Space.
I have nominated Death to the Daleks.
I'm going to nominate the Three Doctors.
And Richard has nominated the Mutants. So those are our four stories.
No! I thought we had an agreement for episode stories only.
People, you do realise that now that you've done that, everyone's going to vote for the Mutants. I think you should cut this whole bit out.
Yes, yes, this gets cut.
I almost nominated Inferno, but I didn't. However, we've also thought about the fact that there's not enough Colin Baker to discuss on the podcast. So at some point in the future, we haven't decided exactly when this is going to go out, we are going to have a Sixth Doctor Big Finish special. So we're going to be reminding you every episode until then which Sixth Doctor stories we'll be discussing. So we recommend you go along to the Big Finish website, bigfinish.com, to download these. So Todd has nominated...
Oh, the One Doctor.
Nathan has nominated
Jubilee.
Richard has nominated Criss Cross, which is one of the newer stories featuring Miranda Raisin. And I have nominated Doctor Who and the Pirates. And we will have links to all of those on the website as well. To stay up to date with all of that, don't forget to check out flightthroughentirety.sexy, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and iTunes, and at FTE Podcast on Twitter. Over on Bondfinger, we have recently finished the Roger Moore era of James Bond, so we have all the Roger Moores, all the Sean Connerys, including Never Say Never Again, and Honor Majesty's Secret Service and Casino Royale 1967. So do check that out, bondfinger.com, Bondfinger on Facebook and iTunes, and Bondfingercast on Twitter. Until we see you next week, may no one deny you your red eyebrows. Thank you very much for listening and good night.
Good night.
See you soon.
That was Flight Through Entirety with Todd Bielby, Nathan Bottomley and Brendan Jones. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb. This episode, Let's Stick Something in It, was recorded on the 11th of February 2017. The next episode will be released on February 26th. I taught an earwig nuclear physics once, and it still knows more about uranium than Donald Trump.
Serverland is actually the only person I've ever cosplayed at an convention. And I had like black press on nails and everything. It was really something.
You fool, Nathan.